Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith.
When powerful states want to avoid accountability, want to avoid critique, they label their opponents terrorists.
Journalist Robert Jensen teaches media law, ethics, and politics at the School of Journalism at the University of Texas at Austin. He joins us for a discussion about media in an age of cataclysm, the BP oil spill, costly wars in the Middle East, and recent Israeli commando raids on the Free Gaza flotilla. We asked him to provide his personal reactions to these stories, starting with the Gulf of Mexico oil disaster, which could be the worst environmental disaster that some reporters will cover in their lifetimes.
I think actually the oil spill is a very important event to take note of for a lot of different reasons. One is, of course, it reminds us of the rapacious and predatory nature of the modern corporation and the way that corporations are really inconsistent with ecological sustainability and inconsistent with justice, really, quite frankly, inconsistent with any conception of a decent human society. So one is that apart from the particular failures of this corporation, it's a reminder that this is the nature of corporations. In that sense, the oil spill really isn't an accident. It's the predictable consequence of the structure of a certain institution, the corporation. It's also a reminder, of course, that we are in fact an unsustainable economy, an unsustainable way of living, that what many people have called an extractive economy, an economy that sees the earth as simply a mine from which we can endlessly extract resources, and then, of course, on the other side, a dump into which we can endlessly dump those toxic wastes from the extraction. That can't go on forever either. It's a reminder of the way in which the state, the government, has so subordinated itself to the corporation, it's unable to really act as a vehicle for public concerns. All of this stuff, I think, is beyond the actual facts of the oil spill are the real crucial questions. And of course, if you get behind that, it's of course easy to point at the state and the corporation as the agents of all of this destruction. But if we're going to be serious about trying to create a different kind of system, it means we individually, all of us who live, especially in the more affluent section of the first world of this planet, our lifestyles are going to have to change dramatically. The first and most obvious indication of that is that we're going to have to live at a much lower level of energy consumption. And I don't just mean, you know, turning the thermostat and driving a hybrid car. I mean a dramatically different way that we live in this world. And until people are willing to confront that, I'm not sure there's much that can be done. So in a way, although the specifics of this oil spill are horrendous, they're emotionally devastating to watch this unfold. There are these bigger questions we should be asking as well. And of course, the media are not, for the most part, asking any of those questions.
There are a few notable exceptions. Individual reporters with McClatchy and NPR have been dogging the story of flow rates from the British Petroleum pipe and how oil is impacting oxygen in the ocean. But for the most part, we're catching only glimpses of what we might call the gigantic gorilla in the room story. It's the environmental emergency we face. One reporter noted that oceanographers he's interviewed are terrified. But overall, we see news anchors go right back to discussing whether or not Barack Obama was forceful, or might Republicans use something he said or didn't say, or his tone, to castrate him politically. This even as emergency regulations are being proposed.
In that sense, I think we can talk about three levels of coverage. One is the crassest, most trivial kind of politicized coverage that you're talking about. What does this tell us about Obama? Is he up? Is he down? This and that. Who, you know, who's to blame for the fact BP didn't do this particular regulatory, you know, regime, whatever? There's something vaguely interesting about that, but it's really quite meaningless in the long run. The second level is to be more serious about reporting on the technological, scientific, and environmental consequences of this, which I think are as dramatic as you're saying. And there is a little bit of that around the edges. The problem with that, even on outlets that occasionally try to report something meaningful like that, like NPR, it's dwarfed by, first of all, a kind of happy talk, which NPR has been pioneering lately, in which you can present the evidence and information about this, but the overall shape of the broadcast remains upbeat and happy because that's what they believe listeners want. there's some of that, even though the context in which it's reported is often inadequate. But then there's this other, the real elephant in the room, the gorilla in the room, the 800-pound gorilla, the gorilla and the elephant mating in the room, whatever metaphor we should use, is the fact that we are in a series of ecological crises, not environmental problems. I don't like the phrase environmental problems because it conceptualizes these as separate, discrete problems that have solutions. There is no solution to the multiple ecological crises that we face. There is only the recognition that a dramatic change in the way human beings intervene into the non-human world is necessary. And if dramatic steps are not taken, at least within the decade, if not 2 decades, perhaps at the most, the possibility of continued human life on Earth at the level that we understand it is unlikely. It really is that dramatic. And that level of conversation is typically dismissed as apocalyptic or, you know, reactionary or crazy. But that's really where I think the media should be leading us, is bringing together the people, not just the scientists, but the cultural critics, the people working in sustainable agriculture, the people working in all of these various venues to say, what's really happening here? The simplest point is that we're facing a serious climate disruption problem, which means that instead of trying to figure out how to drill oil in ever more dangerous ways, we should be trying to figure out how to keep the oil in the ground. That's not even really part of the discussion, unfortunately.
After years of turning away from major investigations of the oil industry, the media has also gotten used to offering what amounts to debates, alternative energy versus oil.
Well, this it dramatically increases the urgency. For the first time in a long time, energy policy and oil is a water cooler conversation. People are talking about it every day. This is the time to act.
PBS and Lehr NewsHour turned to Daniel Weiss of the Center for American Progress to discuss the pros and cons of alternative energy versus oil. Kenneth Green of the American Enterprise Institute repeatedly scoffed at Weiss.
What we need is government help to get private entrepreneurs and innovators to help provide better, cleaner choices. Like, for example, Toyota just made a deal with Tesla to make a sedan that is all electric. And, you know, Ken, one of the reasons why electric cars were abandoned 100 years ago is because the auto companies made a deal with the oil companies and decided to go ahead and pursue that rather than do batteries.
That conspiracy theory has been debunked as many times as Tiger Woods monogamy.
When a judge shot down the White House plan for a moratorium on deep water drilling, the NewsHour's Gwen Ifill found another energy industry supporter, Rayola Dower of the American Petroleum Institute, to debate Kieran Suckling of the Center for Biological Diversity.
We've had 30 years of operation in the deep water in the Gulf of Mexico, operating safely all this time.
I think what we can say about deep water drilling is that it doesn't fail often. But when it does fail, it's catastrophic. It's very similar to the nuclear industry in that sense.
The problem is that the American Petroleum Institute has members like Chevron, and that's one of the NewsHour's primary funders. It's another example of the way corporations influence who gets heard by the media. The same is true for who gets heard by Congress. Plus, there's corporate influence over government regulatory agencies. British Petroleum, in fact, might not have been able to drill at 5,000 feet without their cozy relationship with the Minerals Management Service, MMS. The relationship flourished under Bush-Cheney, and ultimately, MMS granted BP a waiver for existing safety requirements for the very well that blew in the Gulf of Mexico. Environmental groups have long fought the waivers, yet even as the new White House appointee Ken Salazar got his oversight office set up at the Bureau of Ocean Management, McClatchy Tribune reported that MMS had signed off on at least 5 new offshore drilling projects after June 2nd. 3 of them are for depths at over the 500 limit proposed by the Obama administration. 1 is for 1,000 feet. They were approved with the same type of waiver given to BP. Again, Robert Jensen.
Well, I think the underlying condition that you're speaking to is the fact that the corporation has been so thoroughly normalized and unquestioned in this culture that we don't even sort of see the obvious. And the obvious is not only that there was inadequate regulation, but that when you allow corporations to accrue the kind of wealth and power that they do, there will never be adequate regulation because the disparity in wealth that is created by the corporate form will inevitably lead to disparities in power, and that, in fact, it undermines the possibility of a functioning democracy. I mean, we have a democracy. We elect people. You know, there's the surface mechanisms that could be democratic exist, but how democratic this culture is in any meaningful sense of the word, I think, really now has to be questioned. And this is at the core of that question, the fact that there is an entity, the corporation, that is allowed to amass incredible wealth, which means it will amass incredible power. This is one of the ways it plays out. And until we can, I think, start asking those fundamental questions, any solutions or so-called solutions to these problems are going to be, by definition, temporary, episodic, and idiosyncratic. They're not going to be dealing with the underlying structures of power that really shape the society. And that's why anytime there's a story of the magnitude of this oil spill, the media should be thinking about it at different levels. How do we understand the story itself, the events? How do we understand the immediate processes that led to the catastrophe? And then how do we understand the underlying systems, institutions that shape our society? What do we learn about those? And the problem is that the media themselves, of course, primarily corporate in nature, are not interested for the most part in going to that particular level of analysis.
We asked Robert Jensen to comment on Bill Moyers, arguably the best overall political analyst at PBS. Moyers suddenly gone without fanfare, no special done on his outstanding career. He left after a rather surprising discussion of just how bad things have gotten now in America.
Yeah, I think Bill Moyers was at some point probably the only thing on television worth watching in some sense. But I also think we can learn a lesson from the fact that Bill Moyers himself was not all that critical of a person if we're talking about these sort of basic structures. Bill Moyers is a kind of left-leaning liberal. He's a critic, but not really a critic of the fundamental way we see ourselves in the United States, I think. And I think many of the voices he brought into his show on PBS were very important. I think some of the investigative work those shows did was very important. But the fact that Bill Moyers was the best we had, in fact, and by best I mean the most critical, tells you something about the absence. You know, there are lots of other voices, I think, that have a sharper analysis than Bill Moyers, a better critique of the fundamental structure of capitalism, a better critique of the mythology of the United States. And those voices are almost completely absent from any mainstream. It's not just that they're, you know, struggling to stay on the air. They were never on the air. They never had a place in the dialogue. Now, you might say, well, that's fine, those people are crazy, but if they're crazy, then much of the rest of the world is crazy, because when you leave the United States and go into other comparable societies, especially Western Europe, you find that, in fact, those more sharply critical voices are part of the mainstream, not necessarily at the center, but they're part of the political dialogue. And here again, I want to point out, this is not just a failure of journalism, it's a failure of an entire political culture. It's a political culture that has essentially crowded out of discussion some very important perspectives that can help us understand the nature of the crisis we're in. It's hard to know exactly why the United States has developed in such kind of idiosyncratic way, but it is, for me at least, an observation that's very scary.
Fox News locally has focused several times on programs to clean birds in the Gulf of Mexico with Dawn Liquid. The company is now featuring pictures of birds and other animals on their bottle. This ostensibly is all about caring about the birds, and Americans certainly do seem to care. The problem is, many Americans, too, are at risk from financial disaster, due in part to massive U.S. spending on two wars in the Middle East and militarization efforts with Israel in an arms buildup rivaling that of the Cold War era. Meanwhile, poor Americans are not getting the kind of coverage they need to have an impact on Congress or local government. They're becoming invisible to the U.S. media, like Palestinians, El Salvadorans, Hondurans, Guatemalans, or Mexicans have often been invisible when it comes to their need to have a voice in their government or ours.
When you look at U.S. news media reporting on U.S. foreign policy, we see the same problem, that the coverage of the actual event is often sketchy or sometimes absent completely. The immediate processes that led to those events are often covered in a sort of haphazard fashion. But most important is the underlying, really systemic causes of, for instance, U.S. support for death squads in Central America, or U.S. support for, take your pick, either the despotic royal regimes in places like Saudi Arabia or the sort of state terrorism of Israel. It's all the same. It's all based on a posture the United States has in the world to try and increase, deepen its own domination of especially the strategically crucial regions, the energy-producing regions in the Middle East, but also all over the world, including in our own backyard, as it's often said. All of these are part of a deep-seated U.S. foreign policy that transcends Republican and Democratic administrations, transcends liberals and conservatives. It's all part of a imperial project. Now, at its best, the news media might shine a light on the most egregious violation. Sometimes it will talk about the immediate context and the events that led to this problem, but almost never does it talk about that more fundamental level of the systems, the structures, the institutions that lead to this. And as long as it does not help shine a light on that more basic level, the American public will remain in the dark. So the American public will believe that, in fact, U.S. complicity with human rights violations in Central America was necessary because of the fight against communism, which was all a cover story for an attempt at U.S. domination. In the Middle East, we'll hear the same kinds of stories about the U.S. support for democracy in the Middle East. As long as the public can't break through that level of mythology and distortion, even reporting on the events that the news media might do is sort of lost in that fog. And that's really where the media has to come to terms with the limitations of its current approach to this sort of objectivity norm it has. But all of this is sort of off the table. To go into a newsroom, a corporate commercial newsroom, the New York Times, CBS News, whatever, everything we're talking about would essentially sound like a foreign language to them, or would be immediately derided as sort of leftist conspiracy theory. Because in this country right now, and it's not, again, just media, it's the political culture generally, we are unable, in a collective sense, to shine a light on the fundamental systems and institutions that create grotesque inequality in wealth, and therefore a distortion in the political system by virtue of that inequality in wealth. And as you're pointing out, we can look at the ocean, we can look at foreign policy, but the consequences of this internally for an increasingly large section of the American population is also quite dramatic. I would say that one way to think about it is that in the United States now, we have a kind of internal third world, whole parts of the population that have been deemed by people in power to have neither a particularly important role in either production or consumption, and therefore are sort of irrelevant to the economy and therefore irrelevant to the powerful who run that economy. Well, that's a dramatic shift in my own lifetime, in the last three decades, let's say. The increase in the size of that internal third world. And, you know, what we've been talking about essentially is we're kind of lurching toward real crises in domestic policy, in foreign policy, and even perhaps more importantly, in the ecological realities that we face. And these are things we either are going to get a handle on within the next decade or two, or I fear they're going to eventually be beyond our capacity to deal with.
Well, even in some of the better coverage that I've seen, Palestinians, let's say, are shown to be living under extremely poor conditions. We tend to see members of the corporate press start to weave in comments about Hamas rockets. There's never enough detail for people to really fully understand the history or instances, let's say, where rockets were fewer or where there were rockets and what damage the rockets in general can do. We just hear about them in a general way. And so the reality of what Palestinians are really armed with versus what Israelis are armed with tends to fall by the wayside.
It's complex. In some ways, the existence of stories that humanize the Palestinian people, that talk about the suffering of the Palestinian people in some meaningful way, that's a sign of progress. Those stories, literally, you would never see 20, 30 years ago in the U.S. news media. Well, that's a step in the right direction. But as you're pointing out, the framework within which those stories are reported still pretends there's some sort of equality between the Palestinians and the Israelis in this conflict, that Palestinian, you know, sort of completely impotent Palestinian rocket attacks somehow constitute an existential threat to Israel and justify the 08-09 attack on Gaza that was so extreme and so barbaric that most of the world, which has become think somewhat desensitized Israeli violence, was up in arms. Even people in the United States starting to say this is too much. You know, you can look at the coverage of the flotilla disaster where Israel engaged in the most blatantly illegal state terrorism in international waters. And there are people starting to say, well, Israel's going too far. But what you don't see is people looking at the context in which Israeli actions go forward. And that's the real question. Can the U.S. news media break out of its putatively objective framework and start examining the way the world really works?
And why do you think it is, finally, that the question of this land struggle, really, between Israelis, primarily Jews who are living in these settlements, and Palestinians who seem to have no voice in the international courts and who seem to just lose their land and nothing's done about it? It's an appalling history if you look at it closely and with an eye toward international legal rights and fairness. But in terms of the press coverage, it's almost as if the Palestinians play a role that is too controversial, too dangerous in terms of career, too frightening for a journalist who doesn't want to get it wrong, you know, and so they've been just totally marginalized. Would you agree?
Yeah, I mean, this is a place where we learn a couple of important lessons. One, international law works pretty much like the law in the domestic level, which is to say there are two kinds of law. There's law for the powerful and the wealthy, and then there's the law that ordinary people face. And because Israel has always had the support of the United States, it's essentially been able to ignore international law. That's one lesson to learn. The other is that American journalism, to use a phrase that Dan Rather once used, it was actually rather insightful, although he didn't understand what he was really saying, I think. He said in a talk he gave at my university some years ago, when faced with a critique of this kind of news media coverage, he said, well, you know, journalism tends to follow the flag. That is, in covering foreign policy, journalists tend to accept the framework that comes from the policymakers, from the powerful. And as long as that's true, then whatever sets the direction for U.S. policy is not going to completely dominate the news, but it'll set the direction for the news. And as long as that is what we're working with, we're going to work with distortions that follow the desires of the powerful in the United States, which at least for the time being are still relatively in sync, although increasingly complex, with the powerful in Israel. In that rhetoric and propaganda, the Israeli government is no different than every other powerful state. Let's not forget that, you know, at one point the United States branded the African National Congress and Nelson Mandela a terrorist group. I mean, when powerful states want to avoid accountability, want to avoid critique, they label their opponents terrorists. This is not unique to Israel. It's one of the standard propaganda techniques of states. That Israel does it is a function of the fact that the United States allows it to do it. And the United States allows Israel to follow these policies because for the better part of the last 30, 40 years, policymakers in the U.S. have believed that Israel serves the strategic interests of the United States in trying to dominate the energy-producing region of the Middle East. Now, that's not a permanent condition. American policymakers, not for moral reasons, but for purely crass political reasons, might at some point decide that Israel is no longer that kind of strategic asset, and we might see a change in policy. But it's clear that that will not be because of a moral calculation. And the role of decent people, of citizens, of journalists who take their profession seriously, is to provide that consistent, morally based critique. And by moral, I don't mean moralistic or hectoring. I mean based in the fundamental moral principles that guide international law, for instance. Well, that's what we should be doing as citizens. That's what the media should be doing. But we recognize that power distorts all of these things. And the media, of course, they're crucial in this because the public needs a clearer vision of the world if it's going to fulfill its responsibility. And all this sort of feeds. The worse the political culture gets, the worse the media gets, and the harder it is to overcome the distorted political culture. So we have a lot of work to do. I don't want to sound too depressing, but I think the first step is recognizing the kind of hole we're in and trying to understand how we're going to get out of it. And the first step is at least by telling the truth and facing how deep that hole is.
Well, sometimes the truth doesn't fit in with the other discussion going on. I mean, how do you speak to Jews, for example, who see Israel as a spiritual homeland and may not know much in terms of land rights or history, but believe in biblical texts or the Torah and therefore side with Israel? How do you approach that as a journalist and as a human being?
The most obvious thing to say is anybody who thinks that contemporary land disputes can be settled by theological texts from a couple of millennia ago is fundamentally irrational. In a secular world where there are competing conceptions of religion, you can't solve these kinds of disputes by invoking religious texts. And anybody who does, whether they're Christian or Jewish or Muslim or Hindu, they're fundamentally irrational. There's simply no way such a system could work, because that's not really resolving disputes. It's about imposing power. And you have to untangle these claims that are made about land and thousands of years ago. They're irrelevant. If that were the case, of course, the first thing that should happen is all Europeans should leave the United States, because the land claims there are quite clear. You know, we're dealing with a world that isn't going to be defined by these kinds of belief systems. Now, how do you intervene in the thinking of people who have those belief systems? You know, irrational belief systems are very difficult to penetrate for obvious reasons. They're not formed sort of rationally. And if people are not going to engage that way, then it is very difficult to understand where to move. But in the end, none of this is really about religion. It's about land, it's about water, it's about resources, and it's about power. And our role is not to try to persuade somebody that their particular interpretation of a religious text is wrong or right. It's to always come back to those fundamental questions about justice in the world we live in, not in one that, you know, we might speculate about in our head. And that's really what we have to be, I think, focused on. As these large-scale systems on the national and international level continue to degrade and seem more and more impervious to intervention, I've been spending a lot more time locally, trying to work on local organizing, building networks, institutions, and recently even physical spaces that can help us come together at the local level. So a group of us here have purchased a building. We're building a community center that can be that kind of space for people to come together, not because I think we need to abandon, you know, work at the national or international level, but because we really do need strong local roots if we're going to have the staying power over time to contribute to those broader, more international movements. So that's been an important sort of shift in my own thinking also.
Journalist Robert Jensen of the School of Journalism at the University of Texas at Austin. You can find him by searching the university or at thirdcoastactivist.org. On Wednesday, the 22nd, there was another incident at the BP rig. The extraction pipe had to be pulled out so that 100,000 barrels or more began once again to freely flow into the Gulf of Mexico. Next week, we'll hear more on the BP spill from scientist Craig McLean, Assistant Director of Science for the National Evolutionary Synthesis Center. He focuses on the ecological and evolutionary drivers of marine invertebrate biodiversity.
Because a variety of things, ocean warming, ocean acidification, the sort of things that have been going on for a while now, the depletion of the reefs and the fish throughout the Gulf of Mexico, the degradation of the marshes and wetlands along the Gulf Coast, especially around Louisiana, those things were already occurring before the oil spill. And now we've asked all of those systems to take another impact, which is the oil spill. And so the question is now have we pushed all these systems past their tipping points? Have we created irreversible damage?
For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dory Smith. This program is produced in Storrs, Connecticut, and syndicated with Pacifica Network. TalkNationRadio.org for transcripts, audio, and discussions. Write to us at TalkNationRadio@gmail.com.